loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, we'll talk about the U.S. government's new climate change report and the dire crisis facing the planet and humanity. And then today we continue our weekly series every Thursday called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, President Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, pleaded guilty today to a single count of lying to Congress. But does this say anything about the larger investigation into alleged Russian interference into the 2016 election? Next, in an article written by a former CIA officer under the pen name Alex Finley, Politico tries to make an argument that an article in The Guardian yesterday saying that Paul Manafort met in Ecuador's London embassy with Julian Assange was either planted or that sources duped the authors, Luke Harding and Dan Collins. Politico then points the finger squarely at Russia. But isn't it more likely that Luke Harding is just a lousy journalist? Then, President Trump is threatening to withdraw subsidies from General Motors after the company announced the closure of five plants and the layoff of 15,000 salaried workers, and he says that he's on the side of the, quote, American worker. But is he serious, especially in light of the massive tax cuts that GM benefited from earlier this year? And how can the auto workers' union capitalize on this situation and save jobs? And then, Veterans for Peace is a new regular segment about the contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, the country, and the whole world. And finally, furious over being denied a briefing by the CIA director on the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, the Senate last night voted by an overwhelming 63-37 vote to bring to the floor a measure to limit President Trump's war powers in Yemen. And in other headlines, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko has called on NATO to deploy naval vessels to the Sea of Azov. Poroshenko's comments come as part of the unfolding Kerch Strait crisis that saw three Ukrainian ships detained by Russian Coast Guard units. The Russian government responded by saying that Poroshenko's aggressive attitude was motivated by, quote, electoral and domestic policy motives, referring to the upcoming presidential election that Poroshenko was expected to do poorly in. A new report issued by the Campaign Legal Center on the 2018 midterm election has found that for the first time, super PACs have outspent official party committees. The top spending super PAC of the election cycle was the Republican Aligned Congressional Leadership Fund, which spent at least $137 million. The official Democratic Party fund was the fourth largest spender, and the official Republican committee was the fifth largest. Canada announced sanctions on 17 Saudi citizens today. The targeted Saudis are accused of being involved in the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The Lebanese army reportedly carried out extensive raids in Syrian refugee camps in the Bekaa Valley today. Approximately 400 Syrians were detained in the raids. According to reports, the raids were primarily targeting people who have overstayed their residency permits. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the White House approach to climate change. Last week, during the Thanksgiving holiday, the White House did everything it could to bury its own White House report on climate change, which Donald Trump says, quote, he doesn't believe. But the science is in, and climate change is here and is already affecting our health, with extreme heat having an effect on productivity, the food supply, and disease transmission, to name just a few issues. And the last 4 years have been the hottest in recorded history. We're joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff. He is a professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont and the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Towards a Revolutionary Transformation, both published by Monthly Review. And then later in the segment, we'll be joined from Jerusalem by Anthony Lowenstein. He is an independent journalist and author of Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe. First, we start with Fred Magdoff. Welcome back, Fred.
Good to be with you.
Fred, I have to say, just hours before I read about this new report, I read another article talking about how insects are beginning to disappear.
The insect apocalypse.
The insect apocalypse is what it was called. And it was just sort of stumbled on by a Danish man who was thinking about when he was a child and he would go on a bike ride. He was having to constantly swat bugs off of his face. And now he would go on a bike ride with his own child and there were no insects anymore. So he set out to prove this and indeed proved that it was true. Researchers are saying that this is all a part of climate change. So we're starting to talk now about potential catastrophes that are in the offing because of climate change. Can you start us off by talking about that?
Yeah, well, it's a big deal. This is not a trivial issue. Insect world is involved in so much of the biosphere in different ways. You know, insects that provide food for birds. They provide food for fish. They do all sorts of things. You know, with regard to shredding organic matter to in the soil, on the surface of the soil, to make it more accessible to fungi and bacteria to decompose. So they're part of the decomposition process. They do many, many, many different things because there's so many of them. So this is a big deal, and I've noticed it also. I mean, it's clear when you drive at night in the countryside now. You don't see the moths you used to see. We used to have moths and beetles coming, at night to your screens, trying to get in, attracted by the light, and you hardly have any of that anymore. So I've noticed that as well. This is a real phenomenon.
You know, this was a point in this Insect Apocalypse article too, is that even at night, there just aren't moths like there used to be. I remember when I was a kid, I was in high school working at a grocery store, one of the big chains, and in the back room, because it was open, trucks would come to deliver the groceries and such. We had to have those bug zappers all over the place because there were so many bugs at night, mosquitoes and moths and whatever else happens to be flying around, that we couldn't work unless they were zapped. And it was those bugs that the bats eat. Well, now those bugs don't exist anymore. There's nothing for the bats to eat. And then what happens? It's a chain.
It definitely is. It's a cascade of effects, one to the other, to the other. This is a big deal.
When I read this article, again, the article for our listeners, it's called "The Insect Apocalypse Is Here." It's a featured story. The subtitle is "What Does It Mean for the Rest of Life on Earth?" The most important question, perhaps. The author is Brooke Jarvis, and it's published November 27th, 2018. Fred, like John and what you're saying, I too, and I didn't think about this even until I read this article. My windshield used to always be splattered whenever I was taking trips, open road especially, splattered with, dead insects hitting the windshield. And I thought, wait, I haven't really been experiencing that at all. But frankly, I hadn't thought about not experiencing it until I saw this article. These things are happening dynamically, but unless we're, I guess, scientists, or unless, I don't know what it is. Maybe if I was paying more attention, I would have noticed. But it's kind of eerie too that this could be happening and people not really taking note of it.
Yeah, I think it's true. It is kind of eerie. I think what one of the things they point out in the article is that you sort of get used to the new normal. You see some insects, you say, "Oh, isn't that nice?" You don't realize that they were maybe 10 times or 100 times more, 10 years ago. So it's you're having both phenomena. You're having actually disappearance of some species in certain areas, and you're also having decline in numbers of remaining species. So it's something. And I think also it's important to keep in mind that climate change is probably part of the story, but the heavy use of pesticides is probably another, and other toxic materials in the environment. It's not just pesticides, that are put on purposely to kill insects or weeds or fungi, whatever it is. But there's lots of other toxic materials in the biosphere as well, from the stuff they made Teflon with, PFOA. This is a quite toxic material. It's in our water systems. It's in all of us probably now. Who knows what effect that has on insects? I mean, I think climate change is definitely part of the story, but there's a larger picture, I think.
Fred Magdoff is our guest. Fred, the White House issued a climate change report. The focus of the report was about the economic cost to the United States of climate change. It was issued the day after Thanksgiving, Friday, in other words, designed to kill the story. And even when reporters did notice the story, Donald Trump was asked about it, and he said he just didn't believe it. He said, yeah, there is climate change, but he didn't believe it was from, his gut told him it didn't come right. from human activity, I think. I think that was what it was. I think it was his gut this time. Anyway, I saw another story about Alberta, Canada, which used to be too cold to grow any corn, for instance, and now it's got this vast corn crop. According to the article, the temperatures in Alberta, Canada have gone up 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit since the mid-1950s. So, in other words, during my own lifespan, 3.6 degrees, I mean, in such a short amount of time.
Right. It's quite something. The growing season itself has been extended. I think they've got an extra 2 weeks. It's, you know, the end of winter, you know, the last freeze is coming earlier, and the first freeze in the fall is coming later. So I think they're gaining about a week on either side, and that's what's allowed the corn to have time to mature. Plus, they're using very short season corn. But yeah, this is all part of the story. The Corn Belt will move north.
You know, another thing that moves north too is pests. I read an article just recently saying that these beetles that kill pine trees that had never before been seen in Colorado have moved their way up from New Mexico and have entered Colorado. And now there are these vast swaths of pine forest that are just beginning to die. And it's because the temperature has gone up and these beetles can survive now through Colorado winters.
Yeah, I mean, they're going up. They're going north, and they're also going up in elevation compared to their previous range.
Right.
Fred Magdoff is our guest. We're talking to Fred from Burlington, Vermont. He is a professor emeritus of plant and science at the University of Vermont. He's the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Towards a Revolutionary Transformation, both of those books published by Monthly Review Press. I also read, since we're talking about anecdotal things that we've read recently, that 70% of the species of the planet that existed in 1970 are now extinct. Is that accurate?
Well, you know, one of the problems is that we really don't know how many species there are, you know, because we haven't identified them all. So, you know, I think it's probably of known species. And I don't know if it really refers to all species or that was just certain animal species. Don't forget, there's a lot of species.
There's a million species of insects, according to that article. A million species of insects, which is, it's mind-blowing in and of itself.
Well, there's probably more, but those are what have been classified. But, you know, we got bacteria, we've got fungi, we've got all sorts of other, you know, species aside from the animal kingdom. I'm not sure. Let me put it that way. I'd like to see the data itself. I think there has been a tremendous amount of extinctions in our recent history. I mean, the last decades I'm talking about. But the 70% seems like a very, very high number. I've seen the number, but I haven't gone back to check the articles to see what I thought.
Let me ask you real quick, Fred. Aside from climate change, aside from the time period we're in now, just based on evolution and evolutionary natural science, are a lot of species going out of existence no matter what? I mean, is that just part of the life cycle?
Well, no question. I mean, there are extinctions that have gone on for literally billions of years, sometimes violently. You know, when an asteroid hit the Earth, supposedly wiping out the dinosaurs. I mean, that's what the theory is.
I thought that was because Noah forgot to include some dinosaurs on the Ark.
Well, that may have been the issue. But yes, there's a certain number of extinctions that you could expect in a given century, let's say, or a given 1,000 years. But what's happening now is that it's just happening so much more quickly than it did through normal evolutionary processes and the abnormal ones, of course. That must have, when that asteroid hit, that must have, you know, wiped out a lot of other species aside from the dinosaurs. So there was a mass extinction at that time. But aside from that, during normal workings of evolution, you do have some extinctions happening. But it's relatively small compared to what's happening now.
Fred, the UN International Scientific Panel, including 6,000 scientists participated, said the world has 12 years or something like that before we reach what might be an irreversible tipping point in terms of climate change. In other words, an urgent appeal to end carbon pollution or carbon emissions to make a quick transformation, as you put it in the title of your book. What about those timelines? Do you think that's more or less accurate, or is that meant to sort of have a shock value?
Well, you know, they've always been conservative in their numbers. And so my guess is that this is real. If anything, perhaps even conservative again. Things have always been worse than they've predicted in the past, I'm talking about, coming from this international group. I think it's true. I think what happens once you get above a certain temperature, you start having feedback loops, which then cause it to actually occur. More carbon dioxide gets emitted, you know, into the atmosphere as the permafrost melts, and the methane comes out of that, and then the carbon dioxide comes from the decomposing, you know, organic material in the soil, and that's a feedback loop that only happened because it got warmer. So that, you know, they're talking about 1.5 degrees or versus 2 degrees, but my guess is we may be on track for 3 degrees.
We're going to see that catastrophe. We were joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff. Fred is Professor Emeritus of Plant and Soil Science at the University of Vermont and the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation. Now we're joined from Jerusalem by Anthony Lowenstein. He's an independent journalist and the author of Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe. Welcome back, Anthony.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we're talking about this new climate change report and the fact that the change has already happened. It's already come. And as a result, it's affecting productivity. It's affecting the food supply, disease transmission, and it's affecting insect life as well. Talk a little bit about what kind of changes you expect us to see.
Well, this, of course, report on the one hand is devastating for what it talks about in the US, but of course, this problem is global, as listeners will know. And one of the things that we're seeing in certain parts of the world is literally certain coastal areas becoming uninhabitable. We're seeing species literally disappearing. Now, these sort of things happened before climate change, but they've massively accelerated since in the last 10, 15 years. And obviously, parts of the US are particularly vulnerable to that, the coasts being the most obvious, but also areas in the interior as well. And what's so, on one level, unsurprising, the Trump administration, according to the New York Times, didn't overly try to tone down the language of the report, although, of course, they released it on the eve of Black Friday. So most people they hoped wouldn't actually hear about it, but of course they have. And in some ways, Trump himself, of course, has denied that climate change is even an issue at all. So the response from the administration is not surprising, but the actual environmental and economic effects in the US and elsewhere is absolutely devastating. It's only going to get worse.
We're speaking from Jerusalem with Anthony Lowenstein. He's an independent journalist and the author of Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe. Brian, this is something that I think the rest of the world really is well focused on, and it's here in the United States that we're seeing this kind of resistance, especially from the Trump administration.
Yeah, the Trump administration, on behalf of coal companies, oil companies, natural gas companies, the bankers who invest in those companies. Anthony, I'm looking at EcoWatch website, ecowatch.com. 5 things to know before next week's critical UN climate talks. Next week, heads of state and representatives from roughly 200 countries will descend in Poland for the 24th session of the Conference of the Parties of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, informally known as COP24, COP24. The first thing to know is about the overarching goal, and the article states, creating a rule book or a work program on how to implement the landmark 2015 Paris Agreement to limit global warming to well below 2 degrees centigrade by the end of the century, avoid the devastating impacts of climate change. Now, it has kind of a bland, almost ho-hum sort of attitude in the way this article, at least, is being presented. We don't need a rule book or a work program. There needs to be urgent action to stop releasing carbon into the environment. Of course, we live in a world based on nation states, so there has to be agreements between these different government-run nation states. Some are developed countries, some are underdeveloped countries, some are sort of in between. The United States and China are the biggest emitters of carbon. China seems to have taken many proactive steps. The U.S. has taken some, but now we have the Trump administration just put the car into reverse and wants to go backwards. Without international cooperation, how do we go forward in a meaningful way?
With difficulty. Clearly, it's possible. And in fact, there's definitely some hope even within the US. You're not going to get much change with the Trump administration. Of course, there could be a new administration in 2020. So that's, of course, an open question. But there are many states in the US, in your country, that have taken meaningful action, trying to reduce carbon emissions, trying to massively install solar, various other methods. And that's encouraging because leadership will not come from the Trump administration or people around Donald Trump. And there are other countries that are certainly taking action, but we shouldn't also forget that there are a lot of nations around the world who, yes, are certainly more alive to the dangers of climate change and are feeling it every single day, particularly ones that are very coastal-based. And yet, for example, a few months ago, Brazil, one of the largest countries in the world, just elected a president who is a climate change denier and is comes into power very shortly and wants to apparently eliminate all any chance of indigenous life in the Amazon. Now, that's concerning because global action is necessary, but if you can't get global agreement, and to be honest, it's hard to see that happening with various players that are currently around, Trump being one, the leader of Brazil, etc. So therefore, countries need to either take action themselves or states even within the US need to. And of course, the people who are most affected are often the poor and vulnerable, whether they're in Bangladesh or islands in the Pacific, or I'm originally from Australia. And Australia itself is one of the largest coal emitters, producers and sellers in the world. And there's a growing campaign to stop that or at least massively reduce it. Most of that coal has been going to China in the last 10, 20 years. So there is action that's happening, but sadly it's not likely to happen while Trump is president.
Let me ask you too, Anthony, is it possible for Americans to undertake change on their own without government support or government backing and still have an effect on climate change?
I mean, the short answer is simply replacing a light bulb with a more economically or environmentally viable one is not going to do this. I mean, there needs to be, in my view, certainly a large state support. I'm not saying it needs to solely be from the state because obviously individuals have to believe it or there needs to be tax incentives to do so. So, for example, some states in the US now are massively invested in a rollout of solar, which makes sense, particularly in states that have a lot of sun. Australia is a very similar situation with a country that receives some of the most amount of sun in the world every day. So state intervention, I think, is important, but public attitudes also need to change. And that's a very, very difficult thing to do, particularly when, for example, there were recently, as any listener will know, incredibly damaging wildfires in California. According to research that's already been done on the media coverage of that within the US, climate change was rarely, if ever, discussed as a possible cause of that. Now, climate change didn't cause the wildfires, but they certainly accelerated and made them far more damaging and have killed, as far as we know, up to 100, if not more, people. So if the media itself's not doing its job, and there are some exceptions, then that's a problem. And I think a lot of that is partly ignorance, partly hubris, partly too caught up in every Trump tweet. There needs to be a lot of education within the media as well to make people aware this is a problem. It's not just going to happen in 100 or 200 years, but it's happening now and it's only going to get worse as more and more natural disasters, amongst other things, are going to start hitting the US.
Can we have a solution to this problem vis-a-vis the application of new technologies within the current economic and social framework? In other words, the world economy as it's presently constituted, which is basically driven by privately owned corporations, not just energy corporations, but corporations of all types that use energy. What's your take on that?
I think the technology question is an interesting one. Certainly people who are often climate change deniers say, well, technology will solve this problem. If it ever gets that bad, we'll just somehow suck all the awful carbon out of the air. And there's certainly scientists that are developing possibly ways to deal with some of the damaging carbon that's going into the atmosphere. That's a very, very big if. But to be honest, and this is someone who's done a lot of work on disaster capitalism for a long time, the economy as it's currently designed, not just in the US, but in most capitalist countries, is set up for growth. growth is what is defined as progress. And growth normally means, for example, pulling down forests or damaging more environmental areas. That's not a sustainable way to live. And increasingly, a lot of countries around the world are realizing that uncontrolled growth is not, in fact, a way to move forward. The only major political party that I can think of on top of my head in the last year or two that is developing a much more proactive way to deal with this issue is the opposition Labour Party in the UK, run by Jeremy Corbyn. Now, he's not in government and he might not win government, but I think if they do, there is certainly a very real possibility that the UK could, and it's a big could, take a far more proactive method towards not just, it's not a question of going into negative growth, it's about saying that growth itself on its own is not simply a sustainable way to deal with the climate problem. Even Democrats in the US, even if the Democrats win in 2020, which is a very big if, their climate policy is certainly better than the Trump administration and the Republicans. They acknowledge climate change is real, but still not particularly strong. And unless you massively want to reduce your carbon emissions very quickly within years. And there's definitely scientists that have shown that you can go to a zero carbon emitting future within a relatively short amount of time. That requires state intervention to do so. Then America and many Western states are going to be paying a price. But the fact is that poor nations pay a much higher price because they aren't able to actually deal with the problem more seriously.
Anthony, I'm looking at the there's a bill that's coming in front of it has come in front of the D.C. Council, what would be called anywhere else the city council, because we're not a state and not people don't accept the idea that we're just a city. We just call it the D.C. Council. The bill, it's a climate bill. It would move D.C. to 100% renewable energy by 2032. But because the utility company, which has a monopoly control over the disbursement of energy resources, has this monopoly status, they're insisting, and the bill now includes, that any monies that they might lose as a cause of renewable energy sources, that those losses will be passed on to consumers through a rate hike. I mean, it seems as if within the capitalist economic framework, no matter what, the interest of those who are the profit makers, meaning a small part of society, seems to be always the thing that comes first.
Yeah, that's an interesting. I hadn't particularly heard about that proposal you've just mentioned. And clearly, I think what will hopefully happen, I can't speak for this particular initiative, but others, is that, I mean, the reason why the Trump administration and, for that matter, many politicians in the US and in Australia, my country as well, are so enthralled to fossil fuel companies is political donations. It's not simply because of that. It's also ideological. But I do agree that within the current economic system that exists in most Western capitalist states, I think it is arguably, if not impossible, close to impossible to address that issue, which is what Naomi Klein has talked about for years, including in one of her recent books. And the argument in that, I think, is very clear. Unless there is a fundamental shift, not just in economic system, but in thinking, that within the economic system, you cannot simply believe that by tinkering on the edges. I mean, the Trump administration report, which he's personally dismissed, is pretty clear about what the danger will be. I mean, on one level, it's kind of typically written in a capitalist way. It's going to cost America $100 billion US dollars over a period of years. That's true. I mean, obviously, the greater impact is going to be on people's lives and their livelihoods. So, yeah, I think that energy companies have a lot to answer for, and I think some kind of divestment campaigns are important.
That was the voice of Anthony Lowenstein, who joined us from Jerusalem. He's an independent journalist and author of Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe. And we were joined earlier from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff. He's a professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont and the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation. That's available from Monthly Review Press. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala, He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. Kevin, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Kevin, so much again to talk about. We don't have Paul with us because he's busy suing people who need to be sued, and he's in court today.
I'll have to do some heavy lifting.
That's right. But that's okay, because we have so much in the way of news. I want to skip around a little bit from the document that we send to each other, and I want to talk very briefly about something that made me want to laugh and cry at the same time. And this was a situation in Georgia where a poor woman was pulled over. She was arrested. She was held on a $1 million bond. She spent 3 months in jail awaiting trial because the bag of cotton candy that she had in her car, a policeman thought was meth, methamphetamine. It was Heisenberg Blue, apparently. And she spent 3 months in jail before the authorities realized this was just a bag of cotton candy. How in the world can something happen like that in America today?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a good way of reacting to it. We should be incredulous. But there's this test that officers have been using for a number of years now called the NARC-2, and it's very unreliable. It's, in fact, notorious. And if you're someone who's just now learning about this test through what happened to this Georgia woman, then, you know, what you'll realize is that actually this is a problem that has been documented. I mean, in Georgia, going back to June or July, they were looking at how several women were impacted by this. And then you can go even further back, ignoring the major issue of the fact that she had a $1 million bond, which is sort of separate from the fact that this test is unreliable. If you go back, we've had documented examples of this being returning positives when people were analyzing Jolly Ranchers. We've had breath mints that were analyzed. They returned confirmation that they were methamphetamines. We even have one example of a motorist who had an herbal male enhancement product, and that returned a positive.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
And so then eventually, later it goes through the system, some crime lab takes a deeper look at it and returns what is real, which is, you know, that what people were saying all along, this is not methamphetamine.
Yeah, it's not methamphetamine. And, you know, this test, this the NARC-2 is, as you said, notoriously unreliable. It's only something like 50% reliable. And yet police departments around the country continue to use it and to rely on it to make field arrests.
Yeah, and then in this case, you have the situation where this woman, who is now suing, as I understand it, was put in prison and then issued a $1 million bond, which is incredible to me because there are people who commit like far, far worse crimes that are never going to see that kind of a bond issued against them. And we're talking about like what? It had to be a very small amount of product anyways. If we let's give them the benefit and say that it had actually been meth. Should anybody with meth be given a $1 million bond to keep them in jail? That just seems so ludicrous.
Yeah, and they charged her with trafficking, which can be a death penalty charge for holding this cotton candy.
Yeah, it's my understanding that she's a grandmother and was riding in as a passenger. So I don't know, the idea that she was somehow trafficking, you know, I guess first off, they would have had to confirm that she had even put that substance in the vehicle. So there's a lot of presumptions that were made on the part of officers, which we know happens typically in these criminal cases. And as has been shown, they were completely wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Hey, let's move over to prison medical care. This is something that we've discussed on this show a million times, but you've got a new piece at shadowproof.com that you published day before yesterday on prison medical care in Illinois. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I was really blown away by the findings here simply because this is a second report that the federal court has ordered. And we've talked about on this show before how, you know, you have lack of oversight, and then you have egregious examples where oversight is happening, and yet the system is still doing everything flagrantly wrong that people are trying to correct and trying to undo. And so in this case, the investigators, a new batch of investigators went back and looked at the system in Illinois.
examined prison medical care and found that actually it's getting worse, that preventable morbidity and mortality, as they put it, is just as bad, if not worse, than when it was first examined. And at the heart of it, usually in these scenarios, is a vendor or contractor. Their name is Wexford. I know that they're not someone that's as familiar to people as like Corizon. And I don't know a whole lot about where it does all of its business in the United States. But here in the state of Illinois, they basically are not hiring properly credentialed physicians, is what was documented by this report. Not to mention, they went through 33 death records and found 73 episodes of grossly and flagrantly unacceptable care. And I can get into an example, but I just think more broadly speaking, if we're putting this in a national context, one of the things that the report notes is that Illinois is technically the second most overcrowded state prison system in the country. And it's just behind Alabama. And then the fact is that if you look at how the system works, it's one of the top five, if not top 10, if not top five systems that is under delivering on care. It should be expending so much to treat prisoners, but it's actually doing a lot to not spend money on prisoners.
I want to give that example that you wrote about just because it's so egregious and yet at the same time so typical. You write here, one patient had diabetes, decompensated cirrhosis, and an unknown skin condition. She had a fever, hypotension, and swelling around the eyes. She developed sepsis, which is a life-threatening illness that is caused by an infection. She needed to go to a hospital. However, without any diagnosis, the patient was treated, in quotation marks, with oral Bactrim, pushing fluids to combat dehydration, and Tylenol with infirmary admission by phone consultation. It was not until 2 days later that the patient was referred by a doctor to the hospital. When the patient returned from the hospital, there was no report, and it was not clear that the staff knew what had occurred. The day the patient returned from the hospital, she vomited dark red vomit and was hypotensive. The only order was to continue present management, the report adds. The patient had repeated episodes, four bloody vomits during the night. The doctor was called at home but took no action. In the morning, and when the patient was in shock, the doctor obtained a do not resuscitate order from the patient. Her barely legible signature did not match her typical signature, and the signature appeared to have been obtained under duress. Needless to say, she died shortly after that.
Yeah, and I have to imagine, given what we're reading in this report, that all of these examples are a representative of a problem. And so you can imagine that these physicians are coming to these patients, and they don't call them inmates in this report. They actually do treat them like humans, the investigators would say. These are patients, and you're coming to them in this moment when they're not in a state where they can actually think clearly, and you're forcing them to sign a do not resuscitate order. Clearly, that person does not actually know what they're doing when they're putting their signature on that document. If they're even actually signing, I mean, they probably just put the paper, they put a pen in the person's hand, the pen scribbled something on the page, and then that was taken to be a signature. That's likely what happened. I want to squeeze in one more incredible example here, just because I think it rivals some of the stories that you've told to me about your experience in Loretto. And it's also just comes off as absurd. I mean, this is kind of a tragic comedy sort of example in the sense that there was a patient 24 years old with a mental illness who swallowed two plastic sporks in front of a correctional officer. That officer actually watched the young man eat the sporks. The doctor ordered an x-ray, but the problem, as the report points out, is that an x-ray will not show plastic sporks. So the x-ray came back normal. 2.5 months later, a nurse practitioner looked at the patient. The young man had lost 33 pounds. The nurse practitioner didn't really think much of it, apparently. The spork was still in there. It needed to be removed. The patient said something about it. Nothing happened. No action was taken. 54 pounds lost later. There's episodes of abdominal pain, inability to eat, nausea, diarrhea. He's found unresponsive and died. Of course, the autopsy confirms there were two swallowed sporks inside. They caused an esophageal perforation, so inside the esophagus, and it caused death. So that's how this person died. And it's just incredible to me. Someone eating sporks in front of a correctional officer, and these people can't do anything to fix it.
A similar thing happened, actually. It was covered in the New York Times Magazine, where a prisoner in the Supermax, the ADX in Colorado, ate ground glass. And one of the prison guards saw him eating the glass. And when he reported it to the medical unit, the doctor said, oh, he's just eating the glass to get attention. Just ignore him. And needless to say, the glass eventually just ate a hole right through his stomach and he bled to death.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about incident after incident after incident. I mean, there's such a proliferation of mental illness being treated by locking people up. And then you have guards who, either because they don't care or because they're not trained, whatever the reason, they're letting this happen. This is kind of a routine way that the system is actually murdering mentally ill people who are incarcerated in America's prisons.
And that's really exactly what it is. It's murder.
It is murder.
Or depraved indifference, at least.
There's one more thing that I think I wanted to share just because it's egregious, and I don't know that it's standard for state prisons. In one of these facilities in Joliet, Illinois, which is not too far from Chicago for people who are unfamiliar with the state, there is a facility there where inmates are actually locked up for several of them are locked up in Supermax style. It's very excessive and it's unusual for that facility. They're being held 24 hours a day. And then some point in the week, they get about 4 hours of time outside their cell. And what's documented in here is that it actually prevents the nurses from being able to give medication, read tuberculosis skin tests, and appropriately access medical care. That is actually getting in the way of being able to do their job. So part of the reason why people might be coming closer to death is because of this system of putting people in standard conditions of solitary confinement, essentially.
Yeah, because I think that's important, John, because we can blame the individual guard or the individual, I don't know what you call them,
sure,
the other professionals.
Sure, but this is systemic.
They are to blame. They are responsible, but this is systemic.
Mm-hmm. It really is.
This is not an individual failure, even though there are individual failures. This is a systemic failure.
Kevin, I want to move over to a story from New Orleans. There's a really cool thing that's happening there. There's a group called New Orleans Safety and Freedom Fund. And what they do is they raise money to put up bail for poor people who have been arrested. And the charge is irrelevant. Whatever the charge is, these folks pool their money and they put up the bail. The New Orleans Parish District Attorney, though, a guy named Leon Canizero, is furious about this. And he gave an interview to the local Fox outlet recently, in which he said that that this New Orleans Safety and Freedom Fund is playing a very dangerous game with public safety. How is that a dangerous game? Aren't people allowed to...
Only rich people, John.
Yeah, only rich people, I guess, get to participate in their own defenses from the comfort of their homes.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the line that you hear from the law and order crowd. This is what comes from the FOP chiefs, the Fraternal Order of Police Leaders, and frankly from the people who are standing in the way of any sort of just moderate and very mediocre sentencing reform in the Congress, people like Tom Cotton, who are so vocal. You know, this suggestion that anything that is done that will help people who are defendants is somehow going soft on crime. Basically, it's that they're so in the can for the police and that they just want them to have carte blanche to do whatever, that they're harsh. I think some of it has to do with seeing who these activists are and what they stand for, that they probably politically align with left-wing advocates, advocacy, and that they're involved in that kind of activism. It probably turns people off, like this DA. I'm sure that he doesn't like that some group like the New Orleans Safety and Freedom Fund is gaining influence in the justice system that he oversees, and it probably threatens his authority. If you were to ask him, he probably feels like the work that they're doing, as much as it's helping the community, he probably views them as a threat to him. And so what he's saying makes absolutely no sense at all to us who do this show, but it makes sense to him because he absolutely wants these people to remain in jail. And I think as you look through some of what Raven Rakia is, the journalist who did this, she does some excellent work. She contributed this to the appeal. And I think if you scroll down, some of what you find is that these bail funds have been opposed because they are removing a revenue stream for the local justice system that is relied upon. And so she says that this is a user pay system. And so defendants who are arrested are basically, they're being forced to pay into the system to fund the system that is actually punishing them.
Crazy. There's another article, and this is one that Paul published in Criminal Legal News magazine. I have to say I got a kick out of it because I actually have some firsthand experience with a story just like this. The article is entitled, "Nearly all the officers in charge of an Indiana police department have been disciplined, including the chief who keeps promoting them." I was actually in prison with a deputy sheriff from a small police department in Indiana, and he was in prison because he had purchased... He and the chief together had purchased some walkie-talkies with federal funds that were supposed to upgrade the equipment of this department. And then as soon as the walkie-talkies arrived, they sold them on eBay and pocketed the money. Well, they got caught. And when they got caught, both the chief and the deputy were prosecuted. The chief actually died of a heart attack during the prosecution. The deputy was in prison with me. Well, there was only a third guy on this little tiny township police force. So he became the chief. And as it turned out, the whole walkie-talkie thing was his idea in the first place. So he was arrested and prosecuted. And all of a sudden, this township had no police department because they were all either dead or in prison.
The question then is, how did the town react? Were they happy or sad?
I would demand a tax cut because if there are no cops to pay, I want my money back. Go ahead, Kevin.
It kind of brings to mind that like Monty Python thing of like the people who have been sacked are being sacked, and the people who sacked the people who are being sacked are being sacked. That kind of thing where it just keeps going on and on until you actually have nobody left. But those who are listening to the show may have seen the video that came out of Elkhart, Indiana, which, you know, this is actually where I grew up nearby here in South Bend. So the local newspaper, the South Bend Tribune, has been working with ProPublica to do some really excellent investigative reporting on the Elkhart Police Department. And, you know, to try to get people interested, which I think is a tough thing to do when it's in a more rural kind of community. This isn't that much. It's not like Chicago Police or the New York Police Department or the LAPD. So to their credit, they've done some excellent work examining the corruption within this department. People may have seen this video that went around from Elkhart where it showed the police officers punching this man who was in a chair, restrained in a chair during an interrogation. They just started beating him up. And that video was released to ProPublica and was reported widely. And that's ignited a lot of attention to the department. And also because the mayor of Elkhart, his son is actually a sergeant in the Elkhart Police Department who has been implicated in what happened in this incident. And so it's incredible what's documented here at Criminal Legal News, the type of stuff, just to read a few examples of this offensive activity that has been going on. You know, you have witnesses reporting that a fellow officer said he could now check shooting a person off his bucket list. So he's making these flip comments a fatal shooting.
Oh my.
You have a 4-day suspension for an officer who was sending inappropriate emails to officers. One of them included a gruesome photo of a man in another city who, while running from police, jumped or fell from an overpass and was decapitated on a wrought iron fence. And I already know that just from the way that these people are acting, that he probably was joking about this man getting decapitated. And that is probably why it's deemed inappropriate. So you've got this kind of thing, and there's all this discipline. You have reports of domestic violence from an officer who battered a woman and shot her cat. It's definitely systemic. And the thing that really needs to be highlighted here, though, is we pull back and we look at this from a national viewpoint, is that now the mayor has called in the State Department in Indiana, the State Police Department in Indiana, to do the investigation. How many of us here actually think that that's going to get any closer to justice? I mean, the state police are definitely going to be sympathetic and on the side of the Elkhart police officers. They're going to be sympathetic to the police union, if there is one locally, or any police organization in the community. And they're going to try to manage and triage this so that everyone involved gets to keep their jobs. And I'm sure that this Elkhart mayor is probably not going to come to an outcome that is satisfying to the people of the community, who are probably now very concerned about what their police are doing.
That's the voice of Kevin Gostala. We talked to Kevin from Chicago. We talk to him every week along with Paul Wright. Kevin is a writer for Shadowproof.com and the co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. John Kiriakou, there's always so much to talk about. And the reason I think this segment is so important about criminal injustice, and that's what we're looking at, the egregious misconduct of the courts, the prisons, the judges, the police, you name it, within the criminal justice system. It's a big issue because so many people in America are in prison. The United States has 5% of the world's population. Most people might not know that this, the country that calls itself the greatest democracy ever, has one out of every four prisoners, one out of every four in the globe,
in the world,
are right here in America's prisons.
5% of the world's population, 25% of the world's prison population. Kevin, I want to turn to a case in Michigan. It says here that the Michigan Department of Corrections has agreed to amend its policies that dole out harsher sentences to prisoners who are HIV positive than it does to prisoners who are HIV negative. What's that all about?
Yeah, so, you know, we've known for some time, as you think of the legacy of Ronald Reagan's administration and everything that's gone on, that there's always been this inclination to oppose doing anything that is compassionate for HIV positive prisoners. And you know, as much as people have come around to treating people who have HIV and seeing them as human beings, I think there's still this residual bias and or prejudice within the prisons that continues. And so this law that was on the books here, or these policies that were on the books, you're finally seeing a breakthrough here where the Michigan Department of Corrections is willing to no longer allow these harsher punishments. It stems from a settlement in a lawsuit in 2015. So one could reasonably say, why has it taken 4 years for Michigan to do anything to actually fix this issue? Well, you know, if you look at the state right now, the Republicans have conspired to undermine the entire citizen initiative process. So maybe that explains something as to why they haven't changed in the last 4 years. But to this issue, the prisoner, they name him in this article from the Metro Weekly, John Dorn, was an HIV positive prisoner in the custody of the Department of Corrections. He sued the agency after he was disciplined for engaging in consensual sex with another prisoner. He was an HIV negative prisoner. He was found guilty of this offense. He lost privileges. He was moved to a high security facility. He was placed in solitary confinement for more than 21 months. He's also punished with loss of paid work. He lost personal property, access to educational and religious program. He could no longer access the law library. He could not access the telephone. And so he got lawyers together and he challenged this. And as part of the settlement, the agency agreed to make changes so that it could no longer disproportionately punish prisoners who had HIV. So this seems like a small amount of progress, but obviously we know that like that kind of egregious punishment is, you know, even if you deserve to be punished for having HIV, which you don't, but let's just say you did, that list, that litany of things I just described that was done for a single act like that is just incredible.
Yeah, it truly is. We're running a little bit short on time, Kevin, so I want to move to Philadelphia here. There was a terrific piece at a website called The Appeal, theappeal.org, entitled, "Is a Philadelphia Agency's Seizure of Vehicles a New Form of Civil Asset Forfeiture?" This article tells some chilling stories about, for example, It says here in November 2017, E.O. Bishop of Philadelphia was arrested on assault charges after a boyfriend who she said was abusive accused her of striking him with an SUV. City police picked her up after spotting the vehicle parked on the streets weeks later. Bishop maintained her innocence but was cuffed and thrown in a squad car. She then watched in disbelief as an officer hopped into her 2002 Jeep Liberty and drove off. She was found not guilty of these charges. The charges were dismissed, but the cops kept the Jeep and then sold it at auction for $1,155. She sued, as did other people. It was a class action suit. And in September, just a couple of months ago, the city agreed to a $3 million settlement for people who had forfeited cash, cars. In some cases, even their houses were seized and sold by the city police and the prosecutor's office. So they've lost this case. They've settled out of court, but they're still seizing people's property. Tell us about that.
So I think the issue that's important here is the property confiscation and how the reason why you have advocates from organizations like the ACLU that are concerned about what's happening in Philadelphia and why they raise this question of whether they're turning to seizing vehicles in order to maybe circumvent some of the civil asset forfeiture rules, or to, you know, even start a new way of collecting money that they can use, or a way of selling off these items so that they can then bring in revenue that funds their departments. I think it's important just very quickly say that the reason why they're doing this is clearly because they've been relying on this all along. And so all of the reforms leave them without money that they've been using to pamper officers, to probably buy things for their offices that aren't necessary. You know, you find in some of these examples that people are decorating their offices, or you know, they want to go on trips, or that's what you've found in a lot of these cases. But then also, if they do really need the funds to fund the department, or if they do need these funds to do something that involves running the justice system, well then, the fact is they're not willing to go to taxpayers and say that we are going to have to find a revenue source. So they're doing this. There's the civil asset forfeiture, taking advantage of people, confiscating property, is what they've decided to do so they don't have to come to us, the taxpayers, and argue that they need to raise revenue.
That was Kevin Gastala, who joined us from Chicago, as he does every week. Kevin's a writer for Shadowproof.com, and he's the co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.